Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome everybody to this Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Now, this is a very special podcast because we have Matt and Steve Neal. Now, if you follow motor racing in the UK, you'll be aware of the British Touring Car Championship, and no doubt you'll be aware of Matt and Steve Neal. Matt is a three-time champion, and Steve has run one of the most successful teams in British Touring Car Racing for many, many years. But from an international scale, from our international listeners, let's try and give some context about the British Touring Car Championship. What is it, Simon? I'm here with Simon Aaron, who's our features editor and digital editor, Jack Phillips. But Simon, the British Touring Car Championship, tell our international listeners all about it.
Due to my age, I still tend to call it the British Saloon Car Championship because that's what it was when I was growing up. But it's the foremost motor racing championship in the UK nowadays, when we no longer have a national Formula 1 or Formula 5000 championship as we did too many moons ago. And since it was reborn as the British Touring Car Championship in the mid-1980s, it has grown and grown and grown. Its profile in the UK and throughout Europe is huge. All the races are televised. Instead of getting one race a day, we now have three races a day. And it's cultivated some fantastic competition between top-level drivers, as well as guys like Matt, who've been winning 25, 26 years. You've been doing it now, Matt? Something of that order, isn't it?
Yeah, a long time.
But, I mean, as well as some great, talented homespun drivers, we've had some top international talent. Alan Menu, Ricard Rydell, Ivan Muller, Gabriele Tarquini. Some guys with real high-quality racing pedigree behind them. So it's, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon televised staple in the UK nowadays, which it never was back in the day. And you know, it's the best attended in terms of spectator numbers four-wheel championship we have in the UK by a long way.
And of course, what we have with you guys, Matt and Steve, is we have very much a family effort here. As I say, Steve, you've run the team for many, many years, and Matt, you've mostly driven for Team Dynamics in your touring car career, with the odd foray into other teams as well. Why do you stick with the British Touring Car Championship? Let's open with that one. You've been racing in the championship since 1993, I think that's right. Why do you stick with the British Touring Car Championship?
I think as a commercial platform, you know, we have looked at other championships, and we wanted to go World Championship, and we've done things like Bathurst and stuff and gone over there, and we'd love to do World Touring Cars or whatever, but as a commercial platform, it stacks up, you know, with the TV and the coverage and the media coverage. You know, if you're going out to sponsors, which we do all the time, and trying to justify the investment they're putting in, there's nothing compete with it on a national level or on an international level, unless you've got a major manufacturer behind you. So, you know, we're lucky we've had a relationship with Honda the last 10 years in it. But it's UK-based, but it's got a global reach.
Okay. Steve, I'm going to take you back to a circuit that Simon knows well. I'm going to take you back to Alton Park. Can you remember what you were doing on 18th of September 1965 at Alton Park.
I was born about 9 months later.
Do you know what? When I wrote that down, I was thinking, I wonder, 66 you were born, yeah. Right? Okay. It was a pretty good result.
Yeah. It's when we had the first of the crossflow 8-port heads.
Yeah.
And we made our own along with a company called Arden Racing. Jim Whitehouse, who was a brilliant engineer,
he
would cast his own cylinders, you know, and that's, mind you, you had to put a lot of mustard and bars leak into them to stop them leaking. But it gave the rest of the world a bit of a shock in the mini bracket. It was at the height of mini sort of fame, wasn't it, with our current BRDC chairman, Paddy, winning the biggest rally in the world, which was a great thing for him. And it cottoned on all over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was the Gold Cup. And as you say, this was the height of the mini success. And of course, you were a very, very successful mini racer. I managed to find the grid for this race. And these were the names. So Brabham, Clark, Sears, Rhodes, Chris Craft, Frank Gardner, John Fitzpatrick, and yourself. What an extraordinary group of drivers.
I was about to say Rose Gallery, isn't it?
You probably know more. But that must have been, actually, was that quite intimidating to have those drivers that of that calibre, international drivers at the Gold Cup at Alton Park, and there you are with the Mini?
It would have been if I'd been in front of them, I guess. But no, those guys are up and gone.
You know, yeah, the
people like Jack, and he was in a Mustang, wasn't he?
Yes, the Yellow Man car, I think it was.
Which is a good car.
Yeah.
And the Works Lotuses were there, which was spectacular as well.
Yeah.
So there was a bunch of them fighting up the front end for the overall victory, and then you get a group of us tail-enders who are fighting and squabbling amongst ourselves and seeing who's going to come out with top mini. That was important, really.
Yeah.
Because top mini, you got paid to drive them in those days.
Sure.
And you got, if you were a privateer, you got start money as well. So nothing like today.
So you don't pay Matt to drive today, then?
Well, he gets pocket money, not stuff. He passes that on down to his two boys.
Of course, there's a third generation racing there as well. We'll come back to that. So that time, this was the height of the Mini's success. Tell me the technique required to get the most out of a racing Mini in the 60s, because, of course, the racing Minis that we see today, maybe at Goodwood or elsewhere, highly evolved cars. The cars that you drove, not so evolved, different tyres. What were they like to race?
Pretty basic, really. There was initially there were no seat belts, there were no roll cages, there were very limited restrictions on overalls and no mix. You were unusual if you wore a face mask at all, you know, across the mouth and nose. And it was pretty pointless anyway, because it was no bigger than a handkerchief. And in the very early days, of course, we had those blue overalls, which you're supposed to wash in soda or something like that to make the fire resistant.
Fire resistant.
If you dropped a cigarette, you'd be all right. But not very good at that sort of stuff. But it was intriguing. So you also had a really crummy seat. It was like a little fiberglass bucket with no trim on it or anything like that. And we used to use that or take advantage of being without belts by leaning into the corners like a motorcyclist.
Really?
So if you look at some of the old photographs, and the drivers are over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Leaning on the corner.
Was that just simply to try and hang on to the thing, or was it to try and actually create
We didn't have big steering wheels. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of caster on those little things.
Yeah.
And the toe, the offsets on the wheels was increased to try and widen the track.
Yeah.
And that really did cause a few problems with hanging on to it. But
it
worked.
Absolutely. So I wonder if you would mind giving us and our listeners some of your standout races, maybe the ones where you had some real success or ones you simply enjoyed. Give us an idea of your highlights.
I think one that I really enjoyed was the Silverstone in 1960, 7, that was, a Grand Prix support race.
Wow.
And it was a head-to-head with myself and John Rhodes, who's a big pal of mine. He rang me last night.
Did he? So,
and it was nip and tuck all the way, all the way. Yeah. He got some new fancy tyres from Dunlop, which were the newest thing to a slick, and I was still on the old green spots, which was the rain tyre. So the advantage I had in speed was definitely countered out by the advantage he had around the corners. And John was a pretty brave guy as well. So he'd throw a car at the corner at 130 mile an hour just by doing a rally tick with flicking it one way and then throwing it the other, let it slide in and scrub the power off.
Yeah.
But that was a satisfying win. It was half a length over the line at Silverstone after something like 10 or 15 laps.
Wow. Mm. Fantastic. Do you have a kind of a technique? Can you describe the way you drive? Were you smooth and fast? Were you flamboyant? And then I wonder whether there's a genetic link to the way you guys drive. Is it something you've discussed?
Well, it depends who your teammate is, you know. If you and your teammate get on okay, then that's fine. But if you've got a teammate who's a little bit selfish, then things can get nasty just between the two of you.
Yeah.
But principally, my job and I enjoyed doing was supporting John, because John was a brilliant driver. I think, you know, if you're going to counter these guys, John Rhodes was one of the only world famous mini drivers apart from Paddy Hopkirk.
Yes, yeah.
And so I used to look after him, and John Fitzpatrick and Chris Craft. Chris Craft was the naughty one, and I was the naughty one. He was a naughty one in the Fords, and I was the naughty one in the minis. And so we used to battle each other, because Chris was out there to sort of deal with John.
Yeah.
And I was out there to deal with them. So, so that was an issue, yeah. So it was quite physical, yeah.
So when people say that driving standards have sort of diminished in the modern age, in fact, it's nothing new at all.
No, nothing.
So, Matt, let's talk about your earliest motoring memories then. I know that competitively you started out on motocross bikes, but let's talk about Matt Neal growing up and being surrounded by cars and the industry itself.
I guess I never raced until I was 17, and that was on a motocross bike. One of my first cars, I remember I found a car, and it's before internet or anything, you know, so we found a car in the back of the newspaper or somewhere, a Golf, which I fell in love with, and rang the guy and arranged to do a deal with him, and I'd saved up some money and all the rest of it. And then my dad gave me a lift there, and it was a typical do a deal on the car park. And he gave me a lift, and we bought this car, and I'm following him back, and he's in his BMW, and I'm following him back in the Golf. We come off this island, someone steps into the road, he slams the brakes. I don't see the person stepping off the road. And I pile in the back of him and bury this Golf deep into the back of his pride BMW. And then one of the most disturbing moments is I remember looking at him, and he's on the sidewalk. He's got out of his car and he's beating his head on the pavement. And I suppose it was then I knew I was destined for a career in doing cars after that. It's one I've never forgotten, really.
Yeah. And that was your first road car, was it? And last.
It wasn't my first road car. I was about two in by then. Right. I got rid of another two before that. But it was a good lesson learned.
So, from a competitive point of view, motocross to Ford Fiesta XR 2Is, is that right? That was your
yeah. I did motocross for about 4 years. I got to sort of top amateur level, and then I got to a point where I wasn't good enough, I don't think, and I could keep up with the quick boys for a period, and then you have accidents on bikes, don't you? And I kept on having accident after accident. So Dad got me into a car.
Yeah.
He knew Jeff Goodliffe, and the Harrison brothers who were running a Fiesta at the time, and really just to get me away from the bikes, because Mum was going headless. I'd spent a bit of a while in hospital, in and out of hospital with one thing and another. And then I don't think it was a plan to go anywhere or lead anywhere. It just one thing's led to another over the years, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I was under pressure from your mother. He forgets to mention he broke his leg quite badly on one motocross event. Put him out of it for the rest of that year.
Yeah.
And then mother thought that would teach him a lesson. He wouldn't go back. But, you know, secretly he was saving his pennies and he managed to find enough money to buy another bike in the winter. Right. And he went off testing. And he got a vertical climb he was on, and the bike came back over the top of him, and he compressed his spine.
How tall were you before you compressed your spine?
It's not like the Japanese astronaut, you know.
Goodness, but it's interesting that you didn't give up. You know, you had after you broke your leg, you were like, "I'm still going to save. I'm still going to do this." What was the?
I was still on walking sticks at the time.
Really?
Yeah, and I just sort of climbed onto the bike. It didn't really sort of go to plan, but no, I'm a great one for, you know. We all got phobias. Like I don't madly with my height. I don't like heights. But I'm a great one for facing your fears.
Yeah, sure.
And a few years ago, we got the call. Tatey, who was our PR guy at the time. We used to have adjoining offices with a door in the middle. I can remember someone was on to do a promotion to do a wing walk. And I hate flying. I'll get to A to B, but I don't like it. And I don't like heights. And so when I heard this being talked about, I just leant back through the door and I said, "You can tell them to go. I ain't doing that." And then I heard Plato's already agreed to it. I've got to do it. So I did it, and it was really, I'm glad I'd done it. I wouldn't do it again, but it's facing your fears job, isn't it? And I'm a great one for, you've got to do something to get it out your system.
Yeah,
it doesn't always work, but that's what I believe in.
Because was your height, I mean, what are you, 6'5", 6'6"?
Yeah.
Was that actually an issue on a motocross bike? I mean, was it because a lot of scramble riders, motocross riders are sort of like jockeys.
Yeah, but then you look at Dave Thorpe, who's 6'5", multiple world champion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, he's well into his 50s now and he's still ultra quick, super strong. But probably you're right. I wasn't the ideal size and I didn't bounce very well. You know, when I came off, I used to sort of crumple when I hit stakes and things. So,
yeah,
that didn't go well.
So what would the Matt Neal of today tell the Matt Neal of... But when you made your car racing debut, what would you, if you could lean in the cockpit and say, "Listen, son, this is what I've learned," what would you say?
If you get a test, always go first when the car's fresh.
Okay.
So, and whatever they tell you, it's bull. It's all about how about smoothness, about lines, about looking after your tyres. It's all about the stopwatch, because we've been told many things over the years, and it's all about who's the quickest.
Yeah,
that's what it's about.
Have you been much of a racing dad with Matt, Steve? I mean, have you just let him sort of get on and learn? I mean, have you offered advice willingly?
He shouted at me a lot, as I'm now trying to do with mine as well.
I thought on the sort of plotting and scheming side, really, that's where my strength's been, and also helping him out financially, because, you know, if you want to progress, you've got to find more money and you've got to either have a lot of enthusiasm and a successful business behind you. So I've got my eyes on that and eyes on him, and gradually we made it forward. You know, the transition from the Fiestas was quite a big transition to go.
Yeah.
And I walked into Nick Wales' BMW dealership and ordered 3 M3 BMWs.
Yeah.
And an M5. He thought it was his birthday.
I bet, yeah.
Biggest M series buyer in his showroom.
Yeah. To convert to race cars at that point. Because of course that's how it worked, wasn't it? You'd go to a dealer, you'd buy the road car, and then the conversion would take place.
Yeah, that really was a bit of a misguided thing to do, as it turns out, because if you really got to start with a motorsport shell, which is lighter, seam welded all over, and if you start with a production shell, you've got things which are glued together and not really the same as buying a motorsport shell.
Yeah.
Once he wrote it off, the showroom car, and we put a motorsport shell on it, it was unstoppable from there, wasn't it?
So this was 93, am I right in saying, or was it
early?
90
was the M3 debut, production saloons, okay. Yeah. So the jump from a front-wheel drive hatchback to a rear-wheel drive sport saloon. How did you take that as a driver? Did you ever feel overwhelmed by it, or did you just feel, no, this is, because you're an adaptable driver, I guess is what I'm getting at.
I think now you have to be more specialist.
Right.
You have to specialise in front wheel drive, rear wheel drive. You do get a few, but the days of Jim Clark driving a Formula One car one weekend and a Lotus Cortina, you know, Flash has been very versatile where he's jumped in historics, and you know, we all jump in and out, but to be, you know, when BTCC now is 32 cars under a second in qualifying,
yeah,
it's the blink of an eye. It's you can't leave any stone unturned in looking for performance. And sometimes when you're going away driving other stuff, it is a style. You know, you do have to sort of take one chip out and put another chip in.
Yeah.
So when we've gone down to do Aussie V8s, a lot of the UK and European guys have struggled.
Yeah.
One, it's very competitive down there. There's some real quick guys down there. But two, they're such a different beast to sort of get your head around.
Sure. We're going to come back to that as well, the Aussie touring cars. And Jack, I'm going to ask you to paint a picture of a typical touring car race, because Matt has described this idea where, you know, everyone's within a sort of a tenth of a second, and maybe we're used to seeing the NASCAR guys on NASCAR ovals, cars are flashing past. But touring cars is like that on tight, twisty British circuits with a second between the top.
Well, for me, it was in the dark because of its Snetterton in the old night races, which, as a child, that was incredible. Then you go to Brands Hatch and you've got 30 cars, 30 wide going into paddock, and you can see why the stands are full. You can see exactly why they're there. It's entertainment. It's proper entertainment that you don't actually get in other forms of motorsport, other than maybe BSB. And you've got the familiarity on the road as much as possible. You've got, as partisan, you look in the crowd, you've got orange jackets, you've got Plato jackets, you've got people booing, cheering. It's kind of a core motorsport fan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Growing up, for me, it was one of the most important series as well, mainly because of Super Tours and the cars were...
I do think it's one of the things that BTCC does very, very well, and BSB as well, the fan engagement, which, you know, if you go to the British Grand Prix, you can see the cars at a distance from them. But with you guys, I mean, you have the pit lane walkabouts, the autograph sessions, the photo sessions, and I think that's... It's fun, and it pays off because you see 90%, 95% of the crowd are wearing a team jacket or a team hat or a team pullover or a team t-shirt or something. And I think it's fantastic the way the whole thing is integrated.
Yeah, you do get the heroes and the villains. And I'm the hero to some, and I'm definitely the villain to others. So it swings around about. I've been booed as well as cheered.
Yeah.
Death threats.
Yeah,
we've had a lot. Gotta have some death threats.
They get pretty passionate about it. So.
Yeah, well, it's a tribal series, isn't it? And I think that's maybe what's missing in some other series.
You don't get death threats during the autograph sessions, do you?
You know something, I've had, you know, because they're on about social media and what a great thing it is, but it can be an evil thing as well. Mm. And I've had people be really evil on social media, and then 2 weeks later they rock up, oh, can you sign this please? I'm thinking, I recognise you from somewhere. And then the penny drops, and what do you do? So, yeah, go away.
Right, but that was, you were talking about the wheel hire race, were you?
No,
The night race.
Late 90s, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a good one because you used to be able to, because they only light the apex of the corners. So on the straights, you could get away with all sorts of... And there was one there where Ivan Muller was in the Vauxhall, and you got James Thompson and Peter Cox in the Hondas. And Ivan hated Coxie, like with a passion. And we were coming down to the end of the straight, and he gets nudged by someone, goes straight lines the S's, and T-bones Tomo. And anyway, he makes the podium afterwards. And it was the days when we used to have to have a post-race press conference, and we're all sat there, and there was Coxie on the podium, and there was Ivan, and there was, I think it was Will or someone like that. And then there was me sat on the end. And they're going, oh, because they knew Ivan was good mates with Tomo. And they said, oh, yeah, you hit Tomo. He said, yeah, I'm really sorry about that, you know, but if it was this... sat next to me. I wouldn't have given a shit. And then Coxie, then pursues, because there's only one mic between all of us. There's a wrestling match between the two of them as Coxie's trying to get the mic off him to respond. And it was it all kicked off. It was just, all the press guys, I think it was Christmas. They're all writing it down.
Brilliant. All right. 93, we are going to jump around a little bit, but 1993, so question for you, Steve. This was, as an independent team, how much was the decision to go into the independence class business, and how much was passion? Because obviously the relationship between you and the wider business with Team Dynamics and Rimstock is well documented. And of course the promotion was fantastic. But the heart must have been saying, "Yeah, this is going to be fun as well."
Yes, so, yeah. Well, 93, 92, 93. Yeah. Really, I was friendly with Ray Belt, who was running a car down with Vic Lee and his little operation, and we sent our car down to Vic in our truck for him to do some work on for us and go through it and see where we're losing out. And I had a phone call on Sunday, and it was Vic on the phone, and said, "Steve, I hope you don't mind." He said, "I borrowed your transporter to take a car over to Holland, which a guy wanted to buy, and it's some reason or other it's got stopped by customs coming back." And I said, "Yeah, okay, no problem. You should have asked, but I don't mind anyway." And it later transpired that customs had investigated this truck, and our truck was unique in that it had two hideaways underneath the floor of the truck, which were there to take air cylinders. And these air cylinders, one either side, were the downfall of what he was attempting to do, because they searched the truck, they put the dogs in, found nothing, absolutely nothing. Then they discovered the air cylinders. So they opened the taps on the one, no problems, opened the taps on the other, and the dog does a somersault, absolutely. And it was cocaine. And what he'd done, he thought, had done, the tops of the bottles had been cut off.
Yeah.
And the cocaine had been put in the lower half, 30 kilos in each bottle. And he'd manufactured a very small brass case, it's a pressure case, to have compressed air. And so if they did crack the gauges, then they wouldn't smell anything. You know, it would work.
I see.
Unfortunately, he hadn't calculated the length of that brass tube, which has got a point on the end that's attached to the gauges, to the length of the actual case itself. And as it screwed in, it popped a little hole in the bottom of so the air got in with the dust of the cocaine, and that one particular bottle was a bit of a cock-up, which resulted in Vic spending the next 11 years in jail.
Absolutely, and that obviously was the end of his team. Well, what happened to the assets, to everything?
Well, Ray Bowman and unfortunately, it was the same sort of time as, I think it was a Frankfurt show or some sort, and I'd got to go, so I flew off to Frankfurt when this all blew up. And everybody thought I'd done a runner. Something to do with me. So, fortunately, the customs guys had been following this truck for Vic Lee and his partner for some 3 months before. And they knew there was nothing to do with me or Ray Bell.
Yeah.
So Ray and I got together and we did a deal with the receiver on everything at the Vic Lee business. And we walked out with that, owning that between us. I think we're 50-50. We weren't quite 50-50 because Steve Soper had 2.5% for what it was worth. But it sort of gave him an interest. Sure. And we, let's say, a good friendship with Ray Belm helped it move it forward again.
Yeah.
I found a line on the archive.
The Motorsport Archive, yeah.
Prepared earlier. Which said, ideally, this was 1967 in the magazine, it said, ideally Neil would like to run a two-car team on a grand scale, but they're pretty open-minded about it. It all depends on the financial side. So that was 67, so was that 25 years before it all, again, I guess, eventually came together for you.
So there was an ambition from the early days to run a team, would you say?
Yeah.
At least that's what you told our journalist in 67.
Yeah.
And how long I mean, why did it take so long? Because there's a sort of a, there's this period, I'm guessing, with family where you, and you concentrated on the business. But when you came back to it, you went full in, didn't you?
The family was young, as you know, and the kids were growing up, so that kept the missus busy at home, didn't it? And I found a way of enjoying myself with this development. And all the factory teams were two cars.
Right.
So I thought you've got to have two cars to have a proper team.
Yeah.
And it worked out okay, but we didn't really ever get the two cars together, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'd had a sort of checkered career. I did the Monte Carlo in 65.
Yeah.
And then I bought that car back and sold it to Fred Opert. Who people know Fred Opert. He was a race car dealer in Florida. And £900 I got for it, which was amazing, really.
And it just finished the Monte.
Just finished the Monte, yeah. And then I got another car, another new one, and built that up as a group. I think it was Group N to start with, and then we moved straight into this Group 5.
Yeah.
So it sort of went one way, then completely the other way.
Yeah. It was, and this was the era, you mentioned it earlier on, of the 8 port head, wasn't it? Just tell us how important that was to you mini races.
Amazing. the factory team had developed their own 8 port head, which they weren't going to sell to anybody anyway, so... It was a bit pointless going with them. So my brother had got a little Ginetta, and it had got an SCA engine in. Do you remember the little 1 litre two? It was a Formula 2 engine, wasn't it?
Right.
And it was a cracking little engine, that was. Yeah. And I looked at that, and we had it in bits, and the head looked perfect. So I took this over to Jim Whitehouse at Arden, and I said, can you build a mini engine with a head like that on it? And he says, you could do anything if you've got the money. So, so as my credit was reasonably good at the time, didn't last long, we proceeded on that line. And a lot of heartache and trouble. We couldn't get the Lucas injection, the monitoring system. Yeah. So we had to use Tecalovit Jackson, which was a sort of variation on some commercial one they got.
Yeah.
All those little things that went wrong and didn't work out, but then they did in the end, you know, it came good.
Yeah.
And end of 67, beginning of 68, I was offered a drive at Cooper Car Company. By this time, I'd spent out on what I was going to do, and the budget had run out. I'd run off in another tangent as well. I had an aluminium bodied mini made,
right,
body shell by a local hearse manufacturer.
Really?
And it was 100 mil longer on the bonnet. So that was all, so I could get a cross flow.
Get the head on it.
Don't ask me. Really,
becoming a special now.
Commercial suicide that was. Yeah. I started off with Coopers, and that's when Gordon Spice moved into my seat at Arden, and then he joined us at Coopers in 69.
Yeah.
We didn't always get on okay. We had a few differences. He ended up on his roof at Club Corner one day, which...
on his own, was this, or... Was there some assistance?
And his wife, Bird, he called her Bird Spice, Bird. She had quite a vocabulary. It was really good for sort of in the Navy. She used to swear at me something rotten. It was an interesting relationship.
Good times. There's a bit of a segue here to the early 90s and Matt and the Mazda Zdos that you drove. Now, this was this part of the family team, or was this a separate team that you drove for with the Mazda? Was this?
Yeah, that was Roger Dowson Engineering.
That was, and the engine in that was it a little V6 in that car, 2 litre V6? Now, this is probably a lesser known part of your career, but I'd like to know, how was that car? How was the engine, 2 litre V6? And then, of course, you had your accident. So maybe you can tell us about that period of your career.
You have to understand it was a tyre war then. It was Michelin v Dunlop, v Pirelli, v Yokohama. And Yokohama had been the weapon of choice in the early 90s. And then they'd slip back. Mazda had a big thing with Yokohama. Michelin and Dunlop became the tyres to be on, which most of the factory cars would be on. They were factory Mazda cars we were in. Yokohama had done a works deal with Toyota, with Tom's team.
Okay, yeah.
Which was Bailey and Will Hoy, Julian Bailey and Will Hoy then. And they got their arm twisted behind their back to support the Mazda outfit, which they didn't want to do. So we were struggling a bit, so that made the car hard work just because the tyres underneath you. The accident came around. We were down just on the Silverstone National Circuit. Yeah. And David Leslie, my teammate, and I were battling with one of the independents, Chris Goodwin, in a Vauxhall. David was good at a bit of door handling, and so they were going up the straight door handling, and I got a bit of, because they were busy, I got a bit of a run on them out of turn one cops.
Yeah.
Of which Chris Goodwin sort of gets a good door handle off David, starts to lose it, starts fishtailing on the straight, and as I'm coming past on the inside, he just clips my rear bumper. And then that just flicks. It should have been a spin, but it doesn't. We had no aero on the cars back then,
right.
No wings, and it just flicks it and into a multiple of barrel rolls, which seemed to go on forever.
Did you see it coming? Because I watched it again yesterday, and it looks like the two cars are just arrowing in onto you, and then almost as if you can see it happen. In hindsight, you can see it happening. The fact that you're about to get
I thought I'd give them loads of space on the outside. I was over on the inside, and I thought I'm through, and then he clipped me, and I thought, well, that's not going to do anything. And then it goes over, and I'm more annoyed about it going over to start with. And then it was like being in a tumble dryer. I thought it's got to stop at some point. And then I ended up down in halfway between Maggots and Beckett's then, facing the oncoming traffic, but with the front of the car just like a ski ramp because it's all battered in. So then facing, and they didn't red flag the race for about, I don't know, two or three laps. Mm. And you're worried about, because you're coming around Maggots blind, someone just coming straight up the front of the car because I was conscious still.
Yeah.
So the very next time I drove on the Silverstone National Circuit was when I was trying to win my championship in 06. And we went there at the last race of 06, and that's the first time I'd driven that circuit again. And I didn't even register. You know, you're on about things register and anything. Mm. Didn't even register. Someone only told me, reminded me about it afterwards, and I went, oh, yeah, right, okay. Last time I here was Mazda.
So you were conscious, but you'd damaged your ribs. Is that right?
Yeah,
And to this day, do you still have any problems with your ribs?
I get a jab at them every now and then. There's no fallout from that one, so that was okay.
Well,
so.
That's good. Okay, right. Let's move on to. Should we go to 95 then? So this was the first year that you won the Independence Cup.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
We were looking for a car to race with, and we came upon a Ford Mondeo, which was owned by Ford France. And some of the lads went over, had a look at it, said it was good, and we did a deal with them and brought the car back to the UK, took it apart, put it all back together again, as you do, and. That was the start of our relationship with Ford.
Yeah,
it was a genuine Rouse car, you know, because he made quite a few of those, and it was properly done as Andy always did. But it was done with budget in mind. Andy was always very careful with spending his money. Yes. So one or two of the things, perhaps he didn't know about. But being a metallurgist, he used secondary metal to cast his uprights. And that caused us problems because they'd fall in half.
Right.
But that, apart from that, it was a great car, wasn't it?
I think it was a great car. It was basic, but it worked. It was practical engineering, which Andy was always very good at. One of the aces up our sleeve that year is we moved to Dunlop.
Right.
We did a deal with Dunlop, and it was when tyres were free. You could use as many tyres as you wanted. So we were all using qualifiers as well. And Dunlop had the best qualifier. And Dunlop were only on Volvo at that point.
Yeah.
All the other factory teams were on Michelin.
Yeah.
So Dunlop used us as a bit of a pointy stick to sort of poke some of the other factory teams, especially the the Rouse Michelin shod cars.
Yeah.
So because we could have the, I mean, those Dunlop qualifiers back then were just amazing to drive on, absolutely amazing, and yeah, that gave us some great results in the year, didn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's, funny you mentioned that Dunlop qualifier. This is how James Thompson came to fame, because he would keep the qualifiers on for the race.
Right.
So he'd last about 5 or 6 laps and drive his way all through the field, and he'd be up there leading the race, and then finally they had to retire because there were no tyres left on it. Right. But it really did focus the factory teams on this young kid.
Right.
Well, I think it was
strategic.
Piggy's plot, wasn't it? That was.
Yeah. What's it like driving sticky qualies on a touring car then? Do you have one lap? What's the preparation
involved? Depends on the circuit, you know, the layout of the circuit and everything. At Thruxton, which is particularly hard on tyres, you had one lap and you had to go so slowly on your out lap. Then just before the chicane, the last corner, you'd hammer it. And then arriving at that last corner at the end of the first lap, it was 50-50 whether your tyres were going to be in.
Amazing.
So but they are just... I would say to drive you put a fresh set of boots on now.
Yeah.
You have to drive beyond what you think the car's capable of, because fresh set of tyres, you always get that little bit of extra grip and you sort of have to anticipate that. With qualifiers, it goes to another level, because you just your brain's saying this thing's ain't going to stick, and it's just unreal.
Yeah. Was the bump still at church at Thruxton back then?
Oh, it was a big bump at church then. Yeah. It was a good bump then.
Imagine that would be quite entertaining on qualies.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you just hung on. And the thing would, it was like ground effects on the cars. It was fantastic things to drive.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's talk about the evolution of the touring car during this period. So between, you know, 95 and for the next 5-6 years or so, the cars turned into prototypes effectively, didn't they? And your team with the Primera had one of the very best out there. So from a driver's perspective, what was the car? How would you compare a 95 car and a 2000 car to drive?
I don't think you could really. They were very different. Don't forget, when we started back in 92, 93, you had no data logging. You had nothing. You had just a tacho, a temperature gauge and everything. And they... Yeah. Anyway, the engineer knew if you'd over-revved it, is because your belts were loose when you came in, because on the slowing down lap, you'd leant forward, repressed the telltale lever.
It's all coming out now.
I mean, it's completely different to what it is now, or how it ended up. You know, now, they, you know, if a young driver comes in and he's half a second off the pace, they go, oh, right, it's here, here, and here. Just go out and do it again.
Yeah.
And it's monkey see, monkey do. It can be now, when back then it was, in Dad's day, it's if you're off the pace... Go on.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it? You've got to work it out and figure it out with your engineer and how you're going to do it yourself. So it went through a massive transition. They were great. I mean, we all look on back on the Super Touring days with fondness. I think we all do. But it was incredibly unfair the way it was set up. You know, in 94, there was only an Alpha going to win with the wings and everything. So it was in between Tarquini and Simone. 95... I can't remember who was it. The Audis,
with Bieler.
Was that 96? Was Bieler?
Yeah,
that was the only thing that was going to win. 95. It was Bieler. 96. Yeah. It was only going to be a Renault winning.
Yeah.
So it was between Menu and Plato. 97. It was Ricard. It was only going to be a Vop. You know, 99. It was only ever going to be a Nissan winning.
And that was correlated to the money.
You compare it to now, and that was with engines, with tyres, with everything. The first. you'll remember this, the first race, British touring car race, we ever ran as an independent with the same tyres as the factory teams, we won.
Donington.
That was the first time they ever allowed us the same tyres as the factory cars. And you compare that to now, it's such a level playing field, and the quick cars and the factory cars and the quick guys have weight in them, so they're actually disadvantaged instead of advantaged.
Yeah.
So now it's completely, you can come in at any level and you can, there's no reason why you can't fight for the championship. Yeah. When back then it was impossible. You couldn't do it.
Yeah. Okay. This
I
is
think something I'd like to mention here that it, went on in the early days of super touring. There was a minimum driver weight of 80 kilos. And all of the drivers were under 80 kilos except for Matt, who was 100 kilos. And I tried.
Lardy was pretty tubby as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, so
he,
well, Lardy was a bit.
Tim Harvey.
Yeah, but he wasn't as bad as he is now.
the buffet slayer. That's his social handle, isn't it? The buffet slayer. Sorry.
Yeah. Yes. So I tried and tried with teams meetings and what have you with Gal to get the regulations changed so that they would accommodate the 80 kilos by taking 20 kilos of ballast out of the cars. They wouldn't have it. The teams agreed with me when I face-to-face them. But as soon as they got in en masse, they were 99% against me. You know, I didn't have a chance. Yeah. So everybody with an extra 20 kilos in would have made a heck of a difference to Matt's career, because as it was, he was quick enough to win races. So without the weight in, he would have been substantially faster.
Yeah. I think that period was really important for both of your reputations, because your team became the most popular team in the paddock, didn't it? And I think it was the independent spirit. It was the fact that the crowd, as a British crowd, is very knowledgeable. They knew that you were up against it. But also, you took advantage of that. I think the way you engaged with the crowd at that time was unbelievable. And you've kept the same approach, haven't you, from that day forward? You know, you've always been a very open kind of
operation. We had a few antis. We had a sort of running battle with Jenny Birrell, who was the what would you call her, the administrator or something?
Gestapo, token Gestapo. She was the Rudolf Hess of
She obviously didn't like us very much, and nor did she like Rob Collard, because Rob and ourselves were always put down on the somewhere in the other wet paddock. You know, we were actually parked on top of the sewage pit at one time, where she'd put us. Yeah, Adrian Watson used to try and look after us and help us, but she didn't go too far and tread on Jenny's toes, though.
So from the inside, there was maybe some battles, but from the outside looking in, I mean, you became, I found some pictures last night, the huge crowds that we had at Silverstone and Brands.
It's the iconic British underdog, isn't it? And who's got a chance? Like, one of the drivers who I always remember is Nigel Mansell. You know, you love him or hate him, and he was the iconic underdog who would fight every step of the way. And, you know, in touring cars, I'd seen drivers like Steve Soper, where he was a fighter, and that's what I liked. And we used to say, should we go for independent wins or race wins or whatever? And it was no, let's see how far we can get up there. We want to, you know, they say you aim for the stars. If you miss, you might hit the moon. So you still get somewhere.
Okay. Right, this is where I do a segue into a promotion. This is a Mercedes-Benz promotion, chaps. This one is to enjoy the G-Class Ultimate 4x4 experience. Who's done some off-roading here? Come on. Intentionally? Have you done off-road, or was it?
Andrew English from the Daily Telegraph and I got a G-Class stuck in a ditch in Surrey once, which was his fault.
Okay.
So what you needed was this experience.
Yes, arguably, yes.
I found a few gravel traps in my time, so count me in.
Okay, and you've done the Monty. So we have a pretty good experience in the room. Well, this is to start the year off with an unforgettable experience. Please call 0370 400 4000 and quote G-Class Ultimate 4x4. The expiry date is 1 year from the date of purchase and terms apply. Please also visit the Mercedes-Benz World website for more details. So, sounds like fun to me. So, Nigel Mansell, I'm not going to let that one drop. So, you had the opportunity to race a hero, and also from this part of the world. So, we're in the Midlands. Nigel Mansell, a huge hero. I don't know about you, I'd have been like Now you do what you want to do, Nigel. I can't bring myself to race you. That's you're too much of a hero, surely. What was it like? Come on.
Very surreal, because you'd looked at him and admired him, and he'd been the. But I suppose it's the same way as, you know, I get young drivers now coming in, but all they want to do is a piece of you. Because they just, you know, you're a great scalp, aren't you? Like, Nigel was a great scalp for us all to have a race with, and if you could beat him, potentially, yeah. Even better.
Yeah. And what was he like out on track?
He was a trier. You know, I think he was thrown in the deep end to start with. He had a big accident at the Toker shootout. Put him in the bridge, but he came back. And to be fair to him, he got his head round it. He might have struggled a wee bit in the dry, but when he got in the wet conditions, you know, and he came to the fore and he was going to win. He could have won the race back then, but it wasn't for John Clennon sorting him out.
Tiff
put him in the bridge. Yeah. That was another one.
He still hasn't forgiven
him for that.
Simon, tell us about this time when Nigel came into touring car racing. You know, this is a world champion, and he'd been to IndyCars, and he came to the British Touring Car Championship. I mean, it's a measure of the championship itself, but also a measure of Nigel that he would throw himself in.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember. I mean, I wasn't attending many touring car races at that time. I was busy with other things, but I remember the fantastic response. I mean, just working on a weekly newspaper at the time, on Motoring News, as it was called then, and you know, just one of those real buzz front page headlines that week that it you know, just it caused such a you know, I think we all knew it was coming, but it's because the rumour mill had been in overdrive, but when it's actually happened, it was just a fantastic thing for. I mean, the equivalent nowadays would be Lewis Hamilton turning up at the British Touring Car Championship in a year or three.
Absolutely.
Which I don't quite... Fernando Alonso, I can see it happening. Not so sure about Lewis.
Not for Lewis.
But, I mean, that's the scale of the impact it had at the time. Yeah. And I do very clearly remember, I think, driving to work the morning after Tiffgate when the I hadn't been at Donington, and
Tiff still says it's his claim to fame.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know he does,
and still denies that he had any part to play in it.
Yeah.
I just remember switching the radio on the way into the office, probably for press day, and the first thing I heard was Nigel Mansell Hospital. I thought, he's driving a Ford Mondeo around Donington Park. How? and then you saw the footage, and
that's Nigel, isn't it? He either wins or he goes down in flames. It's just poetry.
Yeah, yeah. Jack, he was going to jump in.
Make a gag.
Okay, so let's talk about the £250,000. I know it was a long time ago, but I didn't get any of it. I was at every race for 2 years, Matt.
Did you? Yeah.
You sent the check to a lot of people. So
Graham Steed had your share, I think.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, damn him. Yeah, he fled to Scotland soon after, bought a nice house. Yeah, so that what did that mean for the team? I mean, symbolically, I mean, it was a lot of money, but symbolically, that race, what did it mean for you guys and for the team?
It was euphoria, really. You've got to say that, especially after that pit stop. Jeepers, creepers.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was unbelievable, really. He got the race in the bag, he got the weight of everybody, a simple, straightforward pit stop, changed the tyres, and no problems. And then he stalled.
What happened, Matt?
And I don't know what went through his mind. Fortunately, he had enough gumption to get it going again and went out lying fourth or fifth, was it?
Yeah, which was lucky, because the Nissans back then were notoriously hard to start when they were hot. Yeah. So, fortunately, I hit the fire button and it.
So we hit the ultimate low.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we had the big comeback drive through the field and. The ultimate win, which meant more because of how it was achieved, with being there, then not there, then creeping away. Can he make it? Can he make it? Yeah. Yes, he can. Looks good. You know.
Yeah.
Amazing.
The cars inside are incredibly, you know, you've
got to go with yours,
incredibly noisy. And so there's only twice I've ever heard the crowd cheering from a roar of the crowd from inside the car. One was Mansell at the Toker shootout in 93. And the other one was when we took the lead in 99 for that win. So down the Crane of Curves. So you could hear the crowd from in the car. It was amazing.
And the crowd are a long way from the track at Crane as well, aren't they? I mean, you exit the first corner, but then that's remarkable.
And also it's very open now. It's not exactly an echo chamber. I think it's a very, very wide open bit of land. It's quite amazing.
Do you get goosebumps there when you think about that?
Yeah, you do. You know, I joking apart, I still get people today or, you know, this week or Auto Sports Show in January, and they still come to you. I was there. Yeah. I was there. I watched that, or I saw that, and I was maybe that big or that big or whatever, but I was there and I remember.
Right. At this time, let's talk about some of the other cars that you've driven around the late 90s as well. So you mentioned earlier on going to Bathurst and driving the Australian supercars, but there was also a run in a GT1 Porsche, wasn't there, at Silverstone, which was, well, I can't believe you got in the car in the first place, but you scored a third place, didn't you, in the British GT round, is that right?
Mm.
So how did that come about?
Did it come about? I can't remember, actually. 98, I remember it was 98.
Yeah, it seemed a good idea at the time, as I can understand. We had to borrow the car.
So you borrowed the car, yeah.
What was his name, the Swedish guy?
Yeah, I can't.
I'd like to have that car now. It'd be worth a few pounds.
It would be. Do you know, it sold only a couple of months ago.
Really?
In January, yeah, it came out for sale. I mean, it went around the world, that car. I went to the States. And
I remember sat in the, because what it had done is it had been raining and it was wet. And this lot had the bright idea. They went, no, it's going to dry. It's out there. And I've never raced this thing before. And I'm cooped up in there. And then it's not slow piece of kit. And I'm sort of looking down at everyone's, I said, and they put me on slicks. I said, how come everybody on the grid is on wet?
I can't see much, but I can see that.
But in fact, it was the demon call because the car had got ABS. It was one of the Porsche was the only thing with ABS at that point.
Yeah.
And we came through the field, so it was a good call.
Good result. Did it make you think, oh, I'm going to have a go at sports cars, or was it just some fun? It was an opportunity that came up, and you thought, well, it's good marketing.
You know something? it was the mega those GT1 Porsches. You know, being at Le Mans and everything. We compared the data of it, and the Nissan Primera of '99 was faster through the corners than the ground effect GT1 Porsche. That shows you the level of the super touring era got to.
Yeah.
So, and they were on little 8-inch, you know, the tyres were double the width on the Porsche, never mind all the diffusers and the wings and all the rest of it. So it just shows you the level the touring cars got to at that point.
Yeah.
It was a different style. I've always enjoyed, it was a very much pointed and squirt, get through the corner, pointed and just whoosh, you're off up the thing. Mm. I've always enjoyed touring cars because it's more the combat side, it's me v you.
Right.
You know, your car might not be as good as mine, but you can outwit me and you can do this or do that. And it's, you've got to watch your back as much as watching your front, when GT racing is a bit more purist, you know, behave yourself stuff, isn't it?
So, well, let's talk about not behaving yourself in Australia. Tell us about the fun you had in Australia, because you drove the Primera in Australia, but then you've also driven supercars as well, haven't you? So,
yeah, the first year we got to Australia, The crowds are amazing down there. It was obviously when we went down there with the Nissan, it was pre V8s, so that you hadn't got the real part of tribal crowds. But there's a lot of police presence down there at the bottom of the mountain, and the local Hells Angels chapter policing the top of the mountain, because the police wouldn't go up there because there used to be a police station there and it got burnt down the year before by the fans. And
do you get that Alton Park? Is that?
So actually, there was a motorbike crowd that burned down the Gents Lewes in about 1977. So it has happened. There is previous.
I didn't have a very good run in the V8s, and then I went back there for a couple of times. And the last time I was there, my teammate was Boris Stead.
Yeah.
Lovely guy, great guy, from the States. And they said, look, there was Paul Morris and Russell Ingall in the sister car, and they said, if one car's out of it and the other car runs into a problem, what we'll do is we'll call a code red. It means you've got to put it in the gravel or just park it somewhere. So they call a safety car. It means we can get back, make a pit stop and get out quick.
Right.
And we'd had a bit of an engine problem. So we'd gone a lap down early on. So we were pretty much out of it. And then Russell was in the other car, and they'd had a bit of a problem. So Paul Morris comes up to me, goes, "Oh, mate," he says, "yeah, we're going to have to do this Code Red thing," because he couldn't call it over the radio. Otherwise, he said, "We've got to call a Code Red." Anyway, at this point, Boris is in the car. I went, yeah, get him. He says, because they said, "What are you going to do? He's got to chuck it in the gravel." I said, yeah, tell Boris to crack on. He's looking like an idiot. There's no problem with me. We're out of the race anyway. No. We're going to come in for the pit stop and you've got to go and do it on the first lap. I went, oh, man, you're joking. Because with the V8s, because it was, the Ford V Holden. When I first went there, I was always with Holdens. And they said, if you go off in front of the Ford fans, don't get out of the car. Because they'll just throw beer cans, rocks. And if they understand you're a POM, then they'll really kick off. So then I'm going around and the V8s are not a slow thing to go around in.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to pick a gravel trap to go off in. Looking for the fans which are there and looking where it's not going to damage the car too much. And in the end, I decided that Into the Chase was the safest place because it was far away from everyone. And I had to do it there, so it was Code Red, yeah.
I'm presuming that has only happened once in your career.
Yeah, once in my career.
Pick a gravel trap. Yeah, incredible. Okay, I'm going to go to the Honda relationship now, which started in 2003. And is it 10 years that you've had, that you've effectively been driving Hondas? Because you had a break as well. You drove for Vauxhall for a couple of years, didn't you? So tell me about your relationship with Honda. And, you've stayed on track with Honda. You've had some real success with them. What works? What is the dynamic between you and Honda? And obviously from a marketing perspective, they've done extremely well. But it just works, doesn't it? It feels like you're a Honda man now.
Yeah, I think what works, we've delivered results. That's what works, isn't it? Basically, unfortunately, we missed out on the big times where they poured, or all the manufacturers poured, multi-millions into it. Yeah. Now, like a lot of the manufacturers, everything's on a much tighter rein.
Yeah.
Why has it continued? Because we've delivered results, and we've now got Honda up to be the second most successful manufacturer of all time in British touring car history. So
is it really?
That's over all of them. There's only Ford
behind Ford,
who's been going forever
since
its inception. That Honda's next best now.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about this year. Let's talk about 2018. This again, if my notes are correct, you made your debut in 1988. Is this your 30th year of competition? Sorry about that.
That would be four-wheel competition, yeah.
Four-wheel competition,
yeah. I did two-wheel before that.
Yeah, so 30th year for four wheels. And do you feel as quick as you've ever felt? Do you feel as competitive as you've ever felt? And then I'll ask your dad if he thinks so.
People say you enjoy it. I mean, you mentioned having fun doing British touring cars. I wouldn't say it's fun to drive them. I wouldn't say it's fun to be involved. I wouldn't say it's fun to run cars or anything. It's all about the challenge and the competition and achievement. You still fight like hell to do it. As a driver, it's a different thing for me now. Do I enjoy just driving fast? No. Yes, you do. You get a buzz out of it. But the fun factor is now, what you get off on is the results, doing it as a team, achieving and getting something. We're doing a new car now with the FK8. Which is very exciting, and it's the mountain you've got to climb to get that thing on the pace. And I think we got some pretty clever guys at Dynamics and Neil Brown Engineering and back at Honda, and it's the achievement of doing it all together, doing it as a team, still doing it with Dad, and trying to get a winner out of it.
Yeah,
how do you think? Gordon Shedden announced that he was leaving the team after a long, long run with you. I mean, you guys, you've had a couple of scrapes on track, but it seems generally the time you've been together, you've been very effective as a pair. You've had a really good, strong bond as a team. I mean, how is his moving on to Fresh Pastures going to affect things?
I think it will affect us. You've got to try and bring positives out of whatever happens. And it's a great opportunity for him. It's a life-changing opportunity to go and do the world championship. So good on him. We're still good friends. I'm going to get a bedroom back at my house because he used to live down here enough. He's going to get a bill for the last 6 years' rent because I think he can afford it now, what he's earning. it is going to be different. It's going to put a different dynamic into the team. But, you know, if we bring anyone new in, we're going to make them sing off the same hymn sheet. You know, Flash was blindingly fast, no matter what you put him in. Whether you put him in a GT2 Ferrari, which they did at Spa, I'd never seen the circuit or the car before. Whether they put him in a historic car, anything, you know, a touring car, he proves his mettle. The reason he got the drive, he got a drive in Dubai, never seen the car before, never seen the circuit before, puts it on pole.
Pole, yeah.
So it's, you know, the rest speaks for itself, really.
I mean, what was the secret of the kind of the strength of the relationship between you? Because I remember there was a race at Alton where you took each other, I can't remember if it's his fault or your fault, at Lodge on the last lap. But I mean, you always, despite little things like that, you always seem to, you know, bounce back, and it didn't seem to have any.
Yeah, I guess most of the secret, he did what I told him.
and you gave him a rent-free bedroom.
Well, he stopped doing what I told him when he started beating me all the time. Yeah. So we're still there. I think the pair of us complemented each other with his speed and my experience. So I still think I can pop in a quick lap. So I'd keep him honest. Keep him on his toes, and hopefully the next person we bring in will be the same.
Do you think, you were talking about Flash's versatility, that touring car drivers get an unfair rap almost? They're not considered among the top more versatile drivers when actually they are more.
I agree with you 100%, because when we started racing at Goodwood, down there I felt, you know, working... touring cars, I think people, you know, in the motorsport world look on as more working class. And, you know, sometimes we get some GT drivers coming in, and we sat in the driver briefing, and we'd all lean across, but he's a bit too posh to be here, isn't he? Because it's just too polite. Because it is, the racing is brutal. It's rough. And when we go down to Goodwood, I think they look at Formula One drivers as the elite, sports car drivers as sort of the next best, and touring car drivers, okay, they're pretty average. And it's only when we've gone down and we've raced against the sports car drivers and the things, and the touring car drivers a lot of the time come out on top, that has completely changed in the last 4 or 5 years. And now a lot of the good guys, they're actually pulling touring car drivers into their teams over the other guys, because they get the results.
Yeah.
And at Goodwood, if you get a result for your car, the car goes up in value. So it's a commercial thing.
Yeah. Good question, Jack. We've answered some questions here from our readers. Brian Kemp, Ali Kay Story, and Lorraine Young all asked questions around Flash. So we're coming to the end, so I'm going to ask some reader questions, some brave ones in here. Should we start with a brave one?
Yeah.
Okay. If the opportunity, this is from Dan Wainwright, if the opportunity came again, would you punch Plato in the nose again, and do you still not like each other to that same degree?
Is that to my dad?
Have you punched him as well? Who hasn't?
You know, I've been asked that question a lot of times, and people used to say, is it for the camera or is it genuine? And it was 100% genuine. You know, we weren't hamming it up for the camera, but I remember that particular time at Rockingham, we got frog marched straight past the clerk of the course office, straight to the stewards, and they're giving us a proper rap. And you know, you can have a big fine, you're disgraced, people are looking up to you and this, and we're sort of walking out feeling a bit lighter in the pocket and with a tail between our legs, and about 100 metres from the steward's office are the ITV guys rushing up to us, lads, that was brilliant, can you do it again next round and everything, can you go, well hang on a minute, how come you can go and pay the fine? So there's a mixed message, which is the same with the racing. You know, we all get chastised for being hooligans. But the problem is that it puts bums on seats. So they try and, you know, people want to see aggro. I remember going as a kid saying, oh, it was a great crash at Island Bend or something at Alton Park. Or people want to see that. But you don't want to damage your car or anything. But it's a fine line. The people who are running it and putting the judicial procedures in place that have to walk with it.
Yeah.
You'd have damaged your hand, wouldn't you? He had his helmet on still, didn't he?
Yeah, I had damaged my hand anyway, so I wasn't going to punch him. It's great the way he flinched, wasn't it? Big girl.
So I'm presuming that Nick Mitchell has asked, have you ever
the same
had...
question.
It's basically two pages. Yeah. No, this is only the second Plato one. Have you had discussions with Jason Plato about driving for the team?
Yeah, we have. on numerous occasions, haven't we?
Yep.
So it's not all bad about Jason.
Yeah. You were teammates, weren't you?
For one race, yeah, NASCAR.
Who won?
I think I put the faster. I was faster.
Classic.
He won the race. No, he finished in front of me in the race.
Right. But you were faster.
That's when Jeff Goodliffe was looking after those two cars. And Jason was winning everything there. And Matt got a one-off drive in it, an invitation in. And I think McKay...
Darren Manning, I sat in for Darren. Darren Manning was Jason's teammate. Yeah. And he got an opportunity in Champ Car. So they gave me a call up. And they're different. They were very different to drive. But I managed to...
He drove it the wrong way.
Squeak
to
a
be honest.
Quick lap out of
he
it.
He drove it off the diff. By so it could, using the diff to break the rear end to come out, get oversteer in the car.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't have done that. When he got there, well, when we all got there, the team said to him, this car is good for a 31.2.
Whatever.
Whatever it was, you know. It will not go faster than that.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Matt does a 29.8 or something. Yeah. And Plato's nowhere, is he? And that's impossible. So Plato starts, you can imagine, can't you? Well, we all go home laughing and joking, you know, that'll teach him. But the man says, it ain't going to last more than about three laps because he got the thing so loose on the rear that he was spinning the wheels up and the tyres were going to shred themselves after that.
Yeah.
Anyway, when we came back the next day, the car wasn't even good for a 31. It was more like a 32 because all the bits off Matt's car had been put on Jason's car.
Jason had more experience. He was, he drove me in the race, I'll be fair. Fair credit where credit's due. So
this year we have the BTCC 60 miler, double distance at Snetterton. Becky Kelly. Matt, what are your thoughts on the 60 mile race and are you looking forward to it?
I'd prefer it if it was 60 laps. You know, we want to make it a proper challenge. 60 miles, I think our standard races are 40, 50 miles, aren't they, or something? So it's going to be a bit different. You've got to probably look after your tyres a wee bit because now with the turbo engines and the torque we've got off these turbo engines, you can spin the things up in the first few gears very easily. So the Honda's historically been very good to its tyres. So I'm looking forward to it. Bring it on.
Yeah, brilliant. You'll be there, won't you?
Yeah,
local boy,
and if it's at night,
start a bit later. That'd be what
might be if you have enough safety cars.
True. Okay, we've got three more questions now. So, Matt Stellmarker, favorite corner of any circuit in the world? I'll ask you both. Start with Matt. Favorite corner, any circuit?
Oh man, favorite corner. I'll have to think about this. Go on, ask Dad first.
What's your favourite corner, Steve?
the old Grand Prix circuit, Silverstone Grand Prix circuit, Woodcote corner.
Yeah.
That was a real hang-on. Alton Park had also got the, what do they call it?
Knickerbrook. Knickerbrooks.
No, the left-hander, long left-hander.
Oh, Ireland.
Ireland.
Or Cascades.
You had to take that flat to get a decent time out of it because it went on and on and on. And that took a lot of doing, took a plucking up a lot of courage. And even when you'd done it, you didn't really want to do it again.
So two quick corners.
Very fast corners, I think, yeah.
You're the same, Matt? Would it be a quick corner?
I'm going to be patriotic and go for a corner at a British track. I can think of many corners around the world which I don't like. But for a favourite corner, it would be Hawthorn on the Grand Prix circuit at Brands.
Because
it's slightly cambered. You can be so brave turning into there. You could just carry more speed than the car should go through. And somehow the car gets through every time. It's an amazing amount of grip, but it's big commitment corner. Then it's followed by Westfield, which is completely the opposite. Adverse camera, and it's all going away from you. But those pair, and that's why I think they should keep going with Brands GP.
Absolutely.
And never change it.
Okay, so this is going to be the last one from Nick B, and it's another if question. If you were allowed one more race, which car and track from your careers would you choose, and why? So one car, one track.
Well, people have asked me about favourite cars. Yeah, the last generation Nissan Primeras were pretty special, but when we go to Goodwood and you see all the cars there and everything, which one would you want to drive? And it's only when you actually go back and look at them and sit in them and you realise what buckets of bolts most of them were and how unsafe they all were. And, you know, I always say that the next car, it's the next generation. You know, I look back at my car, I'm driving at that point, say at Goodwood, and you realise how lucky you are to be doing with all the technology we've got in now. It's amazing. I would say the next car, the FK8 Civic is going to be the one I want to choose, because I reckon that's going to be a winner.
Which circuit? Brands GP?
Brands has always been pretty kind to me, so yeah, we'll do Brands. Brands GP, because that's the last one. We'll win it at the last one.
There we go. Steve, would it be a Mini? Would you like to relive one of your Mini races, or would it be something like, you know, the Chevron that you drove? If you could go back and have another go.
Yeah. No, I think it'd be one of that Mini races.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that stacks in the back of your mind was that one race in 67, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Chaps, Matt, Steve, fantastic. Thank you very much for your time and actually inviting us here as well to your headquarters. It's great to see the activity that's going on as well, preparing for this British touring car season ahead. So thanks to Jack as well, and thanks to Simon and to Alan as well for making us all sound brilliant. That's another fantastic Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you at the next one. Cheers.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. The way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.